Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today, our topic is cataracts. We'll be discussing the prevention, causes, symptoms, and treatment of cataracts with Anchorage ophthalmologist Dr. Matthew Guess. You can reach us with any of your questions or comments in Anchorage. You can call us at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Guess, it's a pleasure to have you here. You're a new addition to the Anchorage physician community, I understand, for a couple years.
Yes, yeah. Thanks for having me.
And you're with Ophthalmic Associates. We had Elizabeth Morgan on last week from that program. It just coincidentally, we needed to fill in a slot with someone backed up, and I appreciate your willingness to come on and talk about cataracts.
Of course.
So this is a common problem, particularly as we get older. I notice I'm starting to have some problems.
Yes. So it's estimated that approximately 20 million people over the age of 40 in the United States suffer from some form of cataract. And that actually, that figure increases to over 80% of people over the age of 80 years old.
Well, we'll get back into who, what, when, where, and how, so to speak, a little bit. But I like to start with a little bit of the anatomy. Dr. Morgan last week talked about the eye a little bit. So let's focus on the anatomy again. I know this is a difficult thing to ask anybody to do, to paint such a picture on a radio discussion, but lead us to where the lens is, what it's doing, what its purpose is, and then depending on what you tell me, I may make you know, tell us a little bit more about the lens.
Sure.
I think it's interesting.
Sure. So the lens serves two tools for the eye. The first tool is it serves as provides one-third of the refractive power of the eye, and it provides all of the accommodative or focusing power of the eye. It's located inside the eye behind the iris, behind the colored part of the eye, and it's supported there by some zonules, which are thin fibers that surround the lens for 360 degrees. So it's suspended in a location behind the iris through the pupil and functions for the focusing and refractive power of the eye.
So it's much like a lens on a camera. I mean, people
just like
that
a lens
all
on
the
a
time,
camera.
To
sure.
Envision. Uh-huh. But it's flexible?
It's flexible. So the thought is, with focusing or accommodation, the lens is able to change shape and change thickness. And through that change in thickness or shape, we're able to see from distance objects to near objects.
And so the ability of that lens to focus things has a lot to do with how well we – well, that's not true. I know nearsighted, farsighted is not necessarily on the lens's problem. It's the depth of the eyeball.
It's the length of the eyeball.
And so the lens is automatically designed to do have a focal length, and the size or the shape of the eyeball is what makes us have difficulty with
yes,
vision.
Yes, and most
except
people.
With presbyopia?
Presbyopia is a condition where there's loss of focusing or accommodation of the lens as we age.
Uh-huh. So it becomes stiffer, is that fair to say? Or
the thought is it becomes stiffer and less able to flex and change shape.
What? Take us a little bit more into the anatomy of the lens specifically. What's in that lens?
Sure. So the lens is surrounded by a capsule, and within the capsule of the lens, there's cells that divide. And these cells that divide into crystal lens or lens fibers. And these lens fibers are clear, and they provide that focusing power. Now, the lens size when we're born is approximately 3.5 by 5 millimeters, so it's extremely small. As we age, the lens gets thicker and wider.
Mm-hmm. What provides the nutrition? I learned last week there is no blood vessels
no,
to the lens.
The only time there's blood vessels to the lens is during embryologic development.
Uh-huh.
After we're born, those vessels have regressed, and so the lens is essentially avascular. So the nutrition is provided by the flow of the aqueous fluid inside the eye, and the lens survives on glucose flowing in that aqueous fluid.
Mm-hmm. So does the concentration of glucose affect the ability? What I'm getting at is is diabetes a factor? And I've heard or read or somewhere I understand that somebody with diabetes or high blood sugars, their vision may change a little bit related to that. I'm not sure that's true.
Sure. So with excess glucose in the bloodstream, that translates into excess glucose in the aqueous. Now, the lens is only able to metabolize so much glucose through one of its primary pathways. If there's extra glucose there, it gets converted to a product called sorbitol and fructose. When those accumulate in excess in the lens, there's an osmotic gradient that forms. With that osmotic gradient, you get an influx of fluid inside the lens, which changes the lens's shape abnormally, and you can get fluctuations in vision and refraction in an eye. And yeah, that occurs commonly in diabetics.
Are there other reasons for dysfunction of the structural components of the lens or the supporting structures that may cause problems? I hadn't thought about this until just now. I mean, we think about cataracts as the primary lens problem and aging, but mm-hmm. are there other, I mean, I guess you could dislocate your lens and so trauma could do some.
Trauma, dislocation of a lens can occur. Mm-hmm. Cataract formation.
Sure. Are there other systemic illnesses that affect the lens?
There are in childhood. There are metabolic conditions which can affect the lens and cause cataracts.
Right.
There are other conditions such as Marfan syndrome, which can affect the zonules, which support the lens and cause displacement of the lens.
Right. Yeah, that's a typical finding is dislocation of the lens with Marfans,
mm-hmm.
and that's due to the structural proteins in the zonules then
mm-hmm.
that are loose just
they
like
tend
the,
to be loose and yep. break easy uh-huh. with dislocation of that lens.
Mm-hmm. All right. How would we then, since we're talking about cataracts, let's define what a cataract is.
A cataract in its most basic definition is a degradation in the optical quality of the normal crystalline lens inside the eye.
So there's a number of factors, I suspect, you're going to tell us that will cause that to happen. Age is one, and what else?
So cataracts are more or less considered an age-related change in the eye. But there are other factors that can speed up the progression of a cataract. There are metabolic conditions, such as diabetes, which can accelerate the rate of cataract formation. Conditions such as the amount of UV, B, light exposure we experience throughout our lifetime can affect the growth rate of a cataract. Certain medications can affect cataract formation, such as a topical or oral steroid use can affect cataract growth. Traumatic injury to the eye can affect cataract growth as well.
When I was in training, we used to hear a lot about infections that happened in utero that caused cataracts. And for over 30 years, I've been looking at kids' eyes as best I can with the equipment I have to look for cataracts. I've never seen one. Is how much of an issue is that still? We talked about the metabolic problems that might cause those, but what about infections?
I would say, you know, we tend not to see in children the infectious issues so much with cataract formation. I think probably due to immunizations and adequate care that the kids receive, so mm-hmm. not such an issue anymore.
Let me remind listeners once again, you're listening to Line One, your health connection. My guest today is Anchorage ophthalmologist Dr. Matthew Guess. If you have questions or comments about cataracts, why don't you give us a call? Our local number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org, and we have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. When I was looking into this issue a little bit, there was some factors related to airline pilots and even astronauts, which a lot of things seem to happen to astronauts that don't happen to the rest of us, like osteoporosis, but surprisingly, most of these guys get cataracts. Were you aware of that and what the reason might be for that?
I'd actually heard of that, and I think that's due to the level of radiation that airline pilots and astronauts are exposed to at higher altitudes.
Is there anything that they can do? I guess we can talk about prevention a little bit now. I mean, you would think sunglasses or visors or some of that stuff should help.
So sunglasses with UVB protection and wearing a wide-brimmed hat mm-hmm. When outdoors would be two recommendations to prevent the progression of development of the cataracts.
So we mentioned at the beginning there's a huge number, increasing number of, or your likelihood of having cataracts increases as you get old. I've written down here that if you make it to 75 to 85, about 91% of the people in the U.S., and in my age group, roughly 65 to 74, about 60% of us do. And so as we're having population that's living longer than they've had, do we think it's ultraviolet radiation, or is it even independent of that we'll have problems with cataracts?
I think it's to some degree even independent of the ultraviolet radiation, people would develop cataracts. To some degree, there are normal physiological change in the body. So, I mean, to some degree, there are normal change that occurs.
Just with the normal aging process. Mm-hmm. Who else has to be concerned about cataracts? We talked about, you said some infants may have some metabolic problems that we normally will screen for, some infections. And then as we get older, and then trauma is a big issue, I guess, for ophthalmologists in particular, to try to warn people away from getting their – what kind of trauma would cause a cataract, for example?
I would say the most common type of trauma to cause cataracts alone would be some type of blunt force trauma to the eye. Now, another common injury we see are people who tend to work with metal and metal hammering injuries. Mm-hmm. There can be trauma to the eye that can cause cataracts. But any real blunt force injury to the eye could potentially cause a cataract formation.
Are there different types of cataracts?
There are different types of cataracts. In adults, we'd like to think there are three main types of cataracts that develop.
Tell us about
those. Sure. The three main types. The first is called a nuclear sclerotic cataract, which is an increase in the opacity in the central portion of the lens. They tend to develop the most slowly of the three main types of cataracts, and they tend to affect distance vision more than near vision. The second type of cataract is called a cortical cataract, and these are wedge-shaped opacities that develop inside the lens. These type of cataracts, symptoms include problems with glare when driving at night, and these can be associated with diabetes. The third type of cataract is called a posterior subcapsular cataract, which is a smudge that develops on the back surface of the lens. These cataracts can be associated with, as I mentioned before, either topical or systemic steroid use, and they tend to cause problems with near vision more than distance vision, and they can also be associated with glare complaints. These type of cataracts, posterior subcapsular cataracts, tend to develop in younger people compared to the other two types of cataracts.
Let's, if you don't mind, let's talk about the subcapsular a little bit, since I have a big interest in asthma, and because of the use of both oral corticosteroids, which are much higher dose than the inhaled corticosteroids, because we're always, both as patients and as physicians, concerned about side effects. So tell us, when should we be worried from an ophthalmologic standpoint about the use of steroids? Are we talking a big difference between oral and inhaled because there's a large amount? And in what other situations might we see steroids used that might have to be raise the concern about development of cataracts?
Sure. So I would say there probably tends to be a higher incidence of cataract formation with oral steroid compared to inhaled steroid just because of the total dosage that's received.
And are there other situations? So there's people who might need steroids for lupus or some other things.
So I would say you always have to weigh the benefit of the steroid use with the risk of cataracts and other side effects associated with steroid. The thought would be probably the benefit of the steroid, at least from a cataract standpoint, outweighs the risk of cataract formation.
In most
cases.
And we know that. How often have you, as an ophthalmologist, seen, are the posterior subcapsular cataracts the only cause is steroids?
Or they can be an age-related cataract as well.
So it's not always easy to tell the cause.
Actually, once the cataract's formed, the cataract formed from a steroid versus the cataract formed from an age-related change, they look the exact same.
Okay.
And we tend to think that if there is some history of chronic steroid use or topical steroid use, that it may be caused by the steroid, but there's no definitive way to say that for sure.
Yeah. I think at least I don't want to overplay my cards here, but I think it's very important that people who may have asthma or allergies and are using corticosteroids understand that the oral doses are 1,000 times. We're talking about milligrams versus micrograms. And we do have very, very long-term studies with very little evidence, my understanding. I'm asking you to correct me now, that these cataracts are a big concern when you only use the topic or the inhale. The problem is so many of these people do get oral steroids at some time during the course of their illness, and it confounds that
yeah, I would
factor.
Agree. Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
Yes.
Okay. So generally it's safe, and as you said, we've talked about on the program a lot, you got to weigh the risks and benefits of treatment versus non-treatment. Mm-hmm. And most of the time, you know, at least with asthma, if you can't breathe, what else matters anyway? So you got to use these things to get you under control enough, hopefully, so that you don't need those medications. All right, so let me remind the listeners again, you're listening to Line 1. We're talking about cataracts, a very common problem as we age. If you've got questions or comments, let me give you some phone numbers again. Our local number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. Well, we'll be here till just before about 3 o'clock this afternoon, and this is the only time you can call in or send us an email. So take your time and let us know if you have some questions we can address. Dr. Guest, what about symptoms? We haven't quite gotten to that situation yet. What are the very first things that can happen? And I guess another corollary question is, can you develop a cataract long before you might notice that you have any symptoms?
I would say you could develop a cataract before you notice any mm-hmm. symptoms related to the cataract. The most common complaint we tend to see when a patient presents for evaluation of a cataract is they just have a general blurriness in their vision that's not correctable with a new pair of glasses. In addition to the just general blurriness a patient can experience, they can also say they have glare in their vision, especially when driving at nighttime with oncoming headlights. I'd say those are the two main things we tend to hear from a patient with.
And they can develop rather suddenly, or is it usually a long course?
They tend to be a long course. The nuclear sclerotic version of a cataract is the slowest to developing cataract versus mm-hmm. the posterior subcapsular cataract. Those tend to be the most visually significant earlier in their development. So,
and even though I'm sitting there with an ophthalmoscope looking in people's eyes, I'm suspecting from what I can gather is when I see a cataract, it's pretty well developed compared to what the ophthalmologist can see.
Sure. So if you see it with your direct ophthalmoscope, it's a well-developed cataract.
Right.
You're right. To really look at the subtleties of the cataract, the patient needs a good dilated eye examination, uh-huh. and then to look at the cataract under magnification.
Is that what the slit lamp is all about?
That's the slit lamp.
So I don't have one in my office. Just ophthalmologists, and sometimes optometrists might have a slit lamp or not.
Ophthalmologists and optometrists both have slit lamps.
So to get a good diagnosis, it seems like it does take an eye care specialist of some sort to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
Is there much question about it once you have that procedure done about what's going on?
Once the examination's done and it's determined that the patient has a cataract, the next question becomes whether the cataract's visually significant for that patient. So
how easy is that to determine?
That's a little harder to determine. So that depends on the patient's complaints. And then their daily activities, how the cataract or how their vision affects them. And then what other diseases could be present in the eye that could also affect the vision.
Mm-hmm. As a person like myself, I've had some LASIK surgery, plus I'm developing a cataract. So for a long time, I wasn't sure. I was slowly losing some very distant vision, the mm-hmm. clarity of it, and I had some glare. And I knew we were watching a cataract, and it's still not that big of a deal to me, but I do have some glare, and I have a little bit of loss of my best vision,
mm-hmm.
and so that's typical.
Typical.
And my age at 64 is typical.
pretty typical. you're average.
You know, what's interesting to me is we know about vitamin D is at least many of us don't have enough, which is a vitamin is a ultraviolet B deficiency, so to speak. We make vitamin D to a large degree from the same wavelength that we think is related to cataracts. And so one of the reasons we're seeing more lower levels of vitamin D, I'm choosing my words carefully here, is because we're not outside so much, and yet we still have this risk of that in from being outside at the same time. So what I'm getting at is age has to be something more. It's not all just the ultraviolet light, but I guess professional golfers, people who might be outside, are at higher risk.
Right. So it's definitely not age plays a very important role in the cataract formation. Mm-hmm. So as the cataract grows, the cells inside the lens divide, mm-hmm. and the lens becomes more dense. As it becomes more dense, it becomes more cloudy or yellow in color. Mm-hmm. So that process would go on alone, whether or not, you know, right. you spent your time outdoors or indoors.
Are most sunglasses protective against ultraviolet B radiation?
I think most, even inexpensive glasses tend to provide UVA and UVB protection. The concern would always be that you would get a pair of sunglasses that don't provide any UV protection. And then with the darkness of a tinted lens, the pupil could actually dilate more and allow more of that ultraviolet light into the eye. Mm-hmm. But most glasses tend to provide some level of protection.
So the treatment, it sounds like, is one identification, and then it's an individual variation. If
yes.
I'm a professional baseball player, I might be treated different than a fighter pilot who
yes.
is different than Dr. Woodard, who spends some of his time
yes.
in this studio and
yes.
is not doing all those things.
A rough cutoff for cataract surgery, when we tend to consider it visually significant, would be around the 20/40 range on an eye chart,
mm-hmm.
and that's best corrected vision.
Okay.
So we like to think when a patient sees best corrected 20/40 or worse, that the cataract is probably visually significant and the patient would benefit from cataract surgery. Now that vision can be skewed higher or lower depending on the patient's needs and how well they feel they see.
Okay. I'm looking at a couple of questions. One of them has to do with treatment, and I'm going to delay that email until once we start talking about treatment a little bit. But here's a question that says, is there any kind of diet that can help prevent the cataracts, particularly cataracts or even retinal degeneration, which also was brought up
sure.
in this particular
so
question?
There's lots of more observational studies that don't show any benefit from any certain nutritional supplements.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no shown levels of vitamins mm-hmm. A, C, E that would prevent the development or progression of a cataract.
So eating more carrots does not necessarily.
No. So really, we can't recommend any certain combination of vitamins or minerals that would mm-hmm. help prevent cataract formation or growth.
Okay. How about she asked about retinal degeneration? Are there factors in diet or other issues about
sure.
since she asked that question?
So she's probably referring to macular degeneration,
right.
which is the most common form of retinal degeneration we see. And there are two forms of macular degeneration, dry and wet. For dry macular degeneration, there are certain combination of vitamins that were shown in a large study of over 5,000 people to be beneficial in preventing the progression of the macular degeneration.
Mm-hmm.
So certain combinations of A, C, E, and zinc were shown to be protective in preventing the progression of the dry macular degeneration and associated visual loss with that.
Mm-hmm. Smoking is a big risk factor, I understand.
Smoking is a big risk factor. Smoking promotes macular degeneration and promotes cataract formation. So, yes, both with cataracts and with macular degeneration, the smoking tends to be a risk factor.
Okay. We're about to where we need to take our typical break, and I know we have an email about treatment, so I want to go ahead and do that, Dr. Guest, at this point, and then we'll come back and try to get into some of the more specifics of the surgery that's being done for for cataracts. Let me remind listeners once again, though, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back discussing prevention, causes, symptoms, and particularly treatment of cataracts with Anchorage ophthalmologist Dr. Matthew Guess. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection, and I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, your health connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line 1, your health connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Anchorage ophthalmologist Dr. Matthew Guess, and we're talking about cataracts. You can email your questions or comments to line1 at alaskapublic.org. You'll need to spell out line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at alaskapublic.org. Our local phone number is 550-8433, and our outside toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And please remember, if you're listening tonight between 7 and 8, you're listening to a recorded broadcast, so we won't be able to answer your questions now. And that also means if you're listening now, you need to call and email and or email and let us know your questions. Nicole, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yes, I'm a pilot, one who flies up at altitude, and I also have a pretty high myopia, like negative 8 both eyes. And I've got a history of both cataracts and macular degeneration in my family. And I'm just wondering if there's any connection between, like, high myopia and cataracts or macular degeneration. I already know about the connection between my macular degeneration and that. Mm-hmm.
So there tends not to be a direct connection between the degree of nearsightedness and cataract formation.
Okay, yeah, so I just wondered about that because my mom and my grandfather both have cataracts, so.
And you were aware that flying was apparently a risk factor. I don't know what kind of flying you do, but certainly there was a study we talked about before we came on the air with Icelandic air pilots, astronauts, so certain pilots must have a risk.
I never really knew that. I never knew about that. Makes sense, though, with the and I do wear glasses that have UV protection. So
yeah, so the association, what you're seeing, may be just a coincidence of two relatively common disorders in the same family.
Yeah, I guess it's just bad eyes.
Yeah, so. I guess, you know, and while you're on, Nicole, we didn't ask Dr. Guess, and I guess I should, is there some genetic predisposition? I seem to think there's always a genetic predisposition, but I don't remember reading about any and looking into this.
You know, I think for adult onset cataracts, there tends not to be, there might be a slight genetic predisposition depending on how your parents develop cataracts. But most cataracts that are kind of genetically predetermined kind of develop in infants and toddlers.
So I guess that was just my question. I wondered if there was any connection between strong corrections and cataracts. So.
Yep, I got both also.
And I'm blind as a bat.
By the way. All right, thanks for your call, Nicole.
Thank you very much.
All right, you have a good day. So here's an email that gets back to when's the time to operate. We kind of had talked about it. It's just when it starts bothering you enough. But can a person slow that eventual event is one of the questions this emailer has.
Well, if there are known risk factors, if a patient's a diabetic or if a patient smokes, they can control their diabetes and quit smoking. That would delay the progression of cataract formation. Yeah, those would be the two probably most common things someone could control.
Weight is associated with everything, and lack of exercise. Did that mean anything to you from a cataract standpoint?
You know, I'd say, you know, obesity leads to diabetes, leads to cataract formation.
Okay. That would be the way that would be related. Okay. All right. And another question by the same person is that are there many different ways to operate on cataracts that are generally accepted by the medical community? So we're going into surgical approaches. Is it pretty much everybody does the same thing nowadays?
Well, more or less, the goal is to enter into the eye, remove the cataract, and in the same position, place an artificial lens. Now, there's a few different approaches in terms of the location of the incision and the incision size, but the general technique is more or less all the same.
A question I might have that's kind of similar, is there any risk with delaying the repair, since it looks like we haven't really talked about treatment options, but I think we're going to be told that it's all surgical. Is there any risk for that delay? And I'd like to bring up the pediatric age group again is when we talk about that, because I think there might be a difference in your answer to that.
Sure. So in adult onset cataracts, we tend to counsel patients that there is no risk in delaying cataract surgery. So depending on a patient's vision and how they feel their vision is, we tend to say it's okay to wait. If a patient's not interested in cataract surgery, tend to be okay to wait for the cataract surgery. Now in pediatric patients who develop cataracts, they're at risk for something called amblyopia, which is a sensory deprivation to the eye, which can lead to permanent visual loss even after a cataract's removed. Mm-hmm. So two totally different
approaches. So the difference there, if I can expand on it, and you tell me if I'm wrong again, what's different is you got a developed brain, which we know is making new neurons, but in early infancy and early childhood, there are tracks being laid down that if they're not stimulated, may not ever develop.
Yes.
And so blocking vision in that very critical early point is very important as opposed to an adult, as best we can tell what we know about the brain right
yes,
now.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, let's go ahead and take one more email that we've got, and then we'll take a phone call. This is another one about steroids. It says, I'm on a low-dose, long-term Cortef, 15 milligrams daily for adrenal insufficiency. So they got Addison's disease. My eye doctor's monitors me for cataracts and for high intraocular pressure. Are the side effects of steroids dose-dependent?
So the side effects of steroids are both dose and time-dependent. So, right, the more steroid you take and the longer you take it, the higher risk of cataract formation.
Cortef, there's different kinds of steroids, and so they're also going to be dependent on a little bit on what steroid you're on, and again, as we talked about, why you need it. So in this particular person, sounds like they're doing the right thing. They're monitoring it. She needs it. She does not make steroids. Now, Cortef, 15 milligrams, I'm not enough of an endocrinologist. If she's making, if the replacement dose is the same as the normal production dose in your body, then I would think it should be much less of a risk to her.
Sure.
That
makes
make sense. I don't know the exact answer, but in her problem, she does not make any corticosteroid, which she should be because of her disease, and probably she's just on roughly replacement doses. And so that would be at less risk. But she may want to double check on that because I'm not the expert on it, and you're not willing to make a decision. Answer that one for sure, or do you know?
No, in terms of her replacement
that
15 and whether or not.
Milligrams of Cortef.
I couldn't say for sure.
Yeah, okay. So one question we might ask is the dose you're on equivalent to what you normally make? And in that situation, I think your risk is lower for sure. It would make, or at least that would be my guess on the test question. Okay. All right, Amy, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
I don't know if you've covered this yet, but I'm wondering if you have LASIK surgery, if that put you at a greater risk for cataracts, or if you do develop cataracts, if because you've had the previous surgery, it makes them harder to treat?
Good question.
So previous LASIK surgery does not increase the risk of cataract formation. However, it does make them slightly more difficult to treat. not so much that the surgical procedure is more difficult. That's the same whether you've had LASIK surgery or not. But in terms of cataract surgery, we take measurements of the eye to determine what lens to place in the eye after the cataract is removed. And that could be made more difficult by the previous LASIK surgery. So one of the measurements we take is the power of the surface of the cornea, the curvature of the surface of the cornea. And in LASIK surgery, the surface of the cornea is adjusted. Now, when we try and take measurements after the LASIK surgery is performed, our measurements can be inaccurate and lead us to place a lens inside the eye that doesn't give us quite the correct refractive outcome, which can require glasses after cataract surgery. So in that regard, it can be a little challenging.
So, yeah, as I understand, Amy, you're with the LASIKs, you're having your cornea adjusted, and then now you're going to have a different cataract put in. And the best technology may still lead to a mismatch so mm-hmm. that your vision may not be as acute afterwards. Is that
No, it should still be correctable with glasses to ideally whatever your vision was before the cataract formed, whether that be 20/20 or not. Uh-huh. But our goal would be to eliminate the need for glasses for distance after cataract surgery, and we may not be correct in that regard.
Get that exactly.
Exactly.
All right.
I see. Thank you very much.
You bet. There's another email that's come in, and then I want to spend some time talking about this surgery a little bit more, but this kind of gets us there again. And this writer says that her mother's about to undergo cataract surgery, and I had a slight concern about her and the physician relationship. And the question then is it common practice to meet your doctor, I guess she's saying, for the first time on the day of surgery?
So the more it wouldn't be common to not meet them before surgery.
Okay.
So the recommendation would always be to meet the surgeon before the operation, to have a discussion about cataract surgery, and so that the patient feels comfortable with the person that's going to operate on their eye.
Yeah, and in discussion, how bad it is, and
exactly.
Is this the right time
exactly.
for you to do it, and so forth. So it sounds like most of the time that's what you would expect
yes.
to have happen, and we can't say in this specific situation, but generally
mm-hmm.
that would be.
Generally.
Okay. All right. So let's get back just to basics of treatment. So is there any other treatment besides surgery for cataracts?
There's really no other treatment to improve the vision once the patient's developed a cataract.
Okay.
There's no non-surgical treatment other than counseling the patient about what's causing their vision loss and prescribing the best possible pair of glasses. There's no drops or other treatment that would eliminate the cataract.
Okay. So then what? What? Tell me about the surgery. What's done? What replaces the lens? Is the lens removed?
Sure. So the surgery is done on an outpatient basis. So the patient comes in to the surgery center the morning of the surgery. They're taken back to the operating room. For the surgery itself, most patients are awake the entire time, and they're given medication for relaxation if they need it, if there's any anxiety there.
Mm-hmm.
We typically just need to use eye drops on the surface of the eye to prepare the patient for surgery. During surgery, there's a small incision made in the surface of the eye, the front clear part, the cornea. Through that small incision, we actually go in and remove the cataract with a small handpiece that actually chops up the cataract and sucks it up, essentially.
Mm-hmm. And that's inside the capsule of the lens.
Inside the capsule of the mm-hmm. lens. So all mm-hmm. all this cataractous material is taken out of that capsule. And then once that's performed, within the capsule, we place an artificial lens
mm-hmm.
That gives us the correct power for that patient's eye.
Mm-hmm.
Afterward, there's a shield placed on the eye, and the patient's taken to the recovery room. And normally, within a half hour after surgery, the patient leaves and goes home. The next day, we see the patient in the clinic, and the patch or shield's removed, and the patient started on eye drops.
And the eye drops are pain?
The eye drops are to prevent infection mm-hmm. and reduce inflammation okay. after surgery. Mm-hmm. So essentially, we like to think of this as more or less a painless procedure. Some patients, the night of surgery, say they felt like there was grit or sand in their eye, or they felt like there was a hair in their eye. Mm-hmm. But that tends to be, in terms of pain, what patients experience after surgery. The morning after surgery, they tend to feel like more or less there was nothing done.
Mm-hmm. So, side effects, unexpected outcomes. What's the downside of the surgery, and how often do those things happen?
So, there's the intraoperative complications associated with cataract surgery and the postoperative complications. Mm-hmm. The most common intraoperative complication is a tear in the capsule that we're removing the cataract from. Mm-hmm. And depending on the study that you look at, that can occur as high as 3-4% of the time and as low as, 0.1 or 0.5% of the time. So there's a range depending on the study. You can kind of think of it as 1 in 100 or less experience mm-hmm. a tear in that capsule. Mm-hmm. So that's the most common intraoperative complication. Postoperative complications that we could concerned about are things like infection in the eye called endophthalmitis or retinal tear developing after surgery. Now, the incidence of endophthalmitis or infection in the eye tends to be on the order of 1 in 1,000 to 2 in 1,000. And so for the endophthalmitis, the prevention includes the preparation for surgery and how we clean the eye before surgery and the antibiotic drops that we have the patient on after surgery.
This tear that occurs somewhere roughly about 1%, and again, that's a national statistic.
The tear in the capsule.
Somewhere in the neighborhood of 1% or so.
Less, yeah.
Less. Again, it depends on
the surgeon, the mm-hmm. experience, the eye.
So what's the consequence of that then?
The concern is that if there's a tear in the capsule, that there's pieces of the cataract that can not be removed correctly from the eye. Mm-hmm. So care has to be taken to remove those pieces left behind. The second concern is that the thick jelly, the vitreous inside the eye, can actually come up through that tear. Mm-hmm. And that has to be managed during the surgery. Okay. And then a tear in the capsule increases the risk of endophthalmitis okay. afterward.
Yeah. What, infection.
Infection.
All right. Okay. Let me remind listeners again, we're getting towards the end of this program on cataracts. My guest is Dr. Matthew Guest. We've been talking about the development risks and so forth of cataracts, and we're spending some time now talking about the surgical approach and to cataracts. If you've got questions or comments about anything about cataracts, you're welcome to give us a call. We'll be here for about another 15 minutes to answer your questions. And so my local number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. How long have these implants been used? What's our long-term outcome kind of data now on the use of these things?
So for the most modern version of cataract surgery, we can trace that back all the way to the 60s and 70s.
Okay.
With lens implantation. So I think there's a fairly good track record for lens implantation. And
the long-term outcome seems to be pretty good. I mean, most of your side effects are
going
to
be
up close near the surgery.
In terms of complications?
Complications,
sure.
Right.
Within the first, tend to be potentially within the first few weeks or months after surgery.
What are these lenses made out of? What's the composition?
The two most common lenses are made of acrylic or silicone, so essentially a soft plastic mm-hmm. that's foldable. Okay. Well, the advantage is that these lenses can be folded and placed through small incisions, and then once they enter into where they're supposed to be in that capsule, they unfold and open up. Mm-hmm.
And we have a link to a video that demonstrates that for those who are interested. This is pretty remarkable. I did not realize this was what happened. So I want to point out to anybody who wants to go to our website at line one at alaskapublic.org, there will be a link to an animated video that demonstrates this. And there's several other YouTube videos showing prostheses, I guess, is the thing I'd say. There's several different companies that make them now, and so you evaluate a patient beforehand to finding the right one for their visual needs, or is each company have a supply, a general group that can be used, and you just get in the habit of using one particular brand? Or?
Yeah, depending on where we operate, the surgery center or hospital tends to carry one or two brands. The actual size of the lens is more or less the same.
Okay.
What changes is the strength of the lens or the power that we choose to implant.
And that's individually?
That's individually decided, exactly.
Okay. Lynn, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Well, thank you. I appreciate you taking my call. I had cataract surgery in my right eye probably 7 or 8 months ago. My question is it common to have floaters in that eye, particularly on the outside, the peripheral, and how long do those last, or will they last the rest of my life? And also, occasionally, I'll get white light floaters, just like something white drifting down. Not very often, but occasionally.
So I would say, assuming they had uncomplicated cataract surgery, the floaters may or may not have been there before the cataract was removed, and now you tend to notice them more with that clear lens implanted. So they're not an uncommon complaint we hear after a patient's had cataract surgery. We like to think of most floaters as benign and harmless. But in some people, after cataract surgery, you can be at a higher risk of a retinal detachment. So new floaters, that number in the tens or hundreds of new floaters, along with flashes of light, can be concerning for a tear in the retina or retinal detachment. But I would say for the most part, most people have the floaters in the eye before the surgery, and they just tend to be more noticeable afterward. Now, the brain would normally, over the course of time, hopefully adjust to the floaters and kind of tune them out so they wouldn't be as noticeable to you.
Okay, and no concern about occasionally a white floater, more like a snowflake falling in the periphery or anything like that?
That's a little harder to determine what that could be. That could be, again, just a benign, a normal floater. But it's difficult to say, actually.
Okay. Well, I appreciate it. I hope my brain does get used to it.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, let me also ask you about floaters. Is it also true that as we age, we're more likely to have floaters or begin to pay attention to floaters more anyway?
So the normally thick jelly in the eye, right, over the course of time liquefies. Mm-hmm. And as it liquefies, opacities can form in it. It can actually separate from the retinal surface, at which point people can experience more floaters in their vision. But it's more or less a normal aging process.
I noticed that, again, I hate to use myself as an example, but I got horrible eye problems. That I went through a period where I was having more floaters, and it bothered me enough because I like to play golf. But I just was thinking when the caller made the phone call that if I think about it, maybe I can see those floaters, but they really don't bother me. They don't affect me at all anymore.
Right. People tend to notice them more on more well-lit days,
uh-huh,
or when they're reading a well-lit book,
uh-huh,
with a real contrast to it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the time. They're always there. Mm-hmm. Just your brain can't tune them out as well in those situations.
So generally, floaters are not indicative of anything. However, there can be floaters that can bright flashes that may indicate some retinal problems.
Right.
Okay. Jerry, you're on line one.
Yes, sir. Thank you. I'm going in for, I guess, a preliminary examination for cataracts. I've got cataracts.
Mm-hmm.
Now the question that I guess I meet with a physician for the first time And now, what should I expect? What questions should I ask? What things should I know?
Well, I think you should walk in with an understanding of how your vision is affected. Now, it's the ophthalmologist or the surgeon who has to decide whether your visual complaints relate well to the cataracts that he or she sees in your eye. So the first step to determine is, you know, how your vision is affected.
The right eye seems to be okay. It's just a matter of old age and vision. The left eye, they diagnosed me with cataracts a number of years ago,
mm-hmm.
and I haven't done anything, and my eyesight in my left eye has actually gotten better, and it kind of puzzles me. If I put an extra side of dime glasses on top of my regular glasses, I can read the newspaper with that eye. So am I going in premature, or should I wait longer?
I think to go in and have an evaluation is a good idea. And some people, as the cataracts form, their near vision can improve because of that change in shape of the lens. But when that occurs, people typically sacrifice their distance vision. So it wouldn't be unheard of to have someone say, potentially they feel like their near vision is better, even though their cataracts are developing and someone has told them that they have cataracts that may be ready to be operated on.
Okay, next question is, should I have my cataracts adjusted or whatever they're going to do to me, my lens?
Sure.
So I have distance vision and put on glasses for near vision?
Most people would prefer to have a lens implanted in their eye that corrects them for distance vision, and that would necessitate the need to wear reading glasses for near vision. That would be most people's preference. But that still comes down to a discussion with the surgeon, and it's a case by case basis.
Okay. Should I ask about experience and the kind of equipment they're using?
Oh well,
this is VA, so I don't know how modern they are.
Oh, actually, the VA. I think in my experience with the VA is they tend to have the best microscopes and the best. Lens removal equipment and the best lenses. So I think they provide.
That's good to hear.
Right.
Thank you.
All right.
That's the first favorable thing I ever heard out of the VA. Of course, if we're not going to the VA, we're going to Elmendorf. So
they're
doing the work, not the VA.
Actually, there's been a lot of good information coming out of how the VA has done things in the from a medical standpoint. They really have done a good job. I think it's a general feeling for most of us in the medical profession and what's happened in the VA. So,
I've got a primary care physician who thinks my diabetes is due to my high blood pressure. So after being up for 10 years on 1 gram of methane of metformin in the morning and one in the afternoon, he took me off it altogether. I don't have much faith in that. In the VA, okay?
All right.
I'm seeing an Elmendorf physician, so that makes a difference.
Yeah,
Thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, good luck to you. Mary, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yes, I have a question. My mother had cataract surgery about 20 years ago, and she was one of the 1% where I believe the surgery was successful,
mm-hmm.
but afterwards, her eye never. She would explain it was like looking through wax paper,
mm-hmm.
and I was wondering if there is anything at this point, anything corrective can be done, or you just live with it.
Well, that depends on the overall health of the eye. So, after cataract surgery, some people develop a film. And that membrane behind the eye, which can be treated. But the question would be whether she has other ocular diseases going on, such as glaucoma or macular degeneration, that would affect her level of vision?
Has she seen somebody else and got an opinion about that?
Well, she has been to see someone, and they said that in order to do any other surgery, they would need the original measurement of the eye. In the meantime, her eye has drooped, and, you know, for whatever reason.
I'm looking at Dr. Gessen. He's confused by this, so I think this is going to require somebody seeing her specifically. I guess my general advice would be to make sure you have somebody else seeing her and getting another opinion about what's going on.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just was wondering on the 1%, what do those people end up with?
What are the symptoms when that? And then we were talking about just one particular thing where the capsule gets torn a little bit. So what are the what are the side effects of the capsular problem? Tara, I guess, is what she's asking too.
Oh, so side effects because of the tear in the capsule, the artificial lens may have to be placed in a different part of the eye. You know, with the capsular tear, like we discussed, you have a greater risk for infection in the eye or retinal detachment. But if that problem is managed well during the time of the surgery, the patient can be expected to have a relatively good outcome.
Even with that complication.
Yeah, as good as if they didn't have the complication. So, okay.
So it's possible whatever happened to your mother is not necessarily this 1%. I mean, she clearly appears to have had a complication. And, Dr. Guest does not, I hate to speak for him, but this is one of those things where someone would have to look at her to see what's really going on and then answer your question about what could be done.
Yes. Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
You bet. Good luck.
You're welcome.
Had a email that came in and said they just tuned in, but they want to know, do cataracts recur?
So the cataract that's removed does not recur, but once that clear lens is implanted, what can occur is that the clear bag that the lens is implanted in can become cloudy.
The capsule that's left.
Some people
there.
Can refer to that as a secondary cataract.
Right.
But then the evaluation of that is essentially the same as the original cataract, which is, when does the vision become problematic? If the vision is problematic and blurry and the patient's unhappy with their level of vision, a laser procedure can be performed in clinic to clear up that cloudy capsule.
All right. I got caught. We only got a couple of seconds left. So I guess the major message here is that progressive vision loss over time, particularly in us older people, we ought to be looked at and talked with the ophthalmologist in particular about when is the right time for that person to consider the surgery, which is quite successful and is our only option.
Yes.
All right.
Sounds about right.
All right. Dr. Guest, thanks very much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you. Yeah.
We're going to take a couple of weeks off due to the holidays, and I won't be back with Line 1 until January 9th. If you want to continue with today's conversation, you can join KSKA on Facebook, and you can find our link at our new website, alaskapublic.org. Otherwise, we'll be back January 9th at 2 p.m. with my guest, Ann Guillen. She is a dental hygienist, but more importantly, a prominent national educator on dental caries. That's the disease that causes cavities and affects us all, so why don't you join us at that time? Pat Yack is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Speck is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks for listening, and especially to those of you who took the time to call or email. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.